as with megatons of fission mines in the ship's hold. And yet the others were all smiling. Miller hauled himself up to the acceleration couch Giogu had saved for him, and pointed to the others with his chin. "Someone have a birthday?" Giogu gave an elaborate shrug. "Why is everyone in such a good fucking mood?" Miller said, more sharply than he'd intended. Giogu took no offense. He smiled his great red-and-white teeth. "Aldi Nix?" "No, I haven't heard, or I wouldn't be asking," Miller said. "Mars did the right thing," Giogu said. "Got the feed off Eros, put two and two, and..." The boy slammed a fist into his open palm. Miller tried to parse what he was saying. They'd attacked Eros? They'd taken on Protogen? "Ah, Protogen. Protogen and Mars," Miller nodded. "The Phoebe science station," he said. "Mars quarantined it." "Fuck that, Bampo. Autoclaved it, then. Moon is gone. Dropped enough nukes on it to split it subatomic." They better have, Miller thought. It wasn't a big moon. If Mars had really destroyed it and there was any protomolecule left on a hunk of ejecta... "Tu sabes?" Giogu said. "They're on our side now. They get it. Mars-OPA Alliance." "You don't really think that," Miller said. "Nah," Giogu said, just as pleased with himself in admitting that the hope was fragile at best and probably false. "But don't hurt to dream, Keno." "You don't think," Miller said and lay back. The acceleration gel was too stiff to conform to his body at the dock's 1/3 G, but it wasn't uncomfortable. He checked the news on his hand terminal, and indeed someone in the Martian Navy had made a judgment call. It was a lot of ordnance to use, especially in the middle of a shooting war, but they'd expended it. Saturn had one fewer moon, one more tiny, unformed, filamentous ring, if there was even enough matter left from the detonations to form that. It looked to Miller's unpracticed eye as if the explosions had been designed to drop debris into the protective and crushing gravity of the gas giant. It was foolish to think it meant the Martian government wouldn't want samples of the protomolecule. It was naive to pretend that any organization of that size and complexity was univocal about anything, much less something as dangerous and transforming as this. But still, perhaps it was enough just knowing that someone on the other side of the political and military divide had seen the same evidence they had seen and drawn the same conclusions. Maybe it left room for hope. He switched his hand terminal back to the Eros feed. A strong, throbbing sound danced below a cascade of noise. Voices rose and fell and rose again. Data streams spewed into one another, and the pattern recognition servers burned every spare cycle, making something from the resultant mess. Julie took his hand, the dream so convincing he could almost pretend he felt it. "You belong with me," she said. "As soon as it's over," he thought. It was true he kept pushing back the end point of the case. First find Julie, then Avenger, and now destroy the project that had claimed her life. But after that was accomplished, he could let go. He just had this one last thing he needed to do. 20 minutes later, the klaxon sounded. 30 minutes later, the engines kicked on, pressing him into the acceleration gel at a joint-crushing high-G burn for 13 days, with 1G breaks for biological function every 4 hours. And when they were done, the half-trained, jack-of-all-trades crew would be handling nuclear mines capable of annihilating them, if they screwed it up. But at least Julie would be there. Not really, but still. It didn't hurt to dream. Chapter 47. Holden. Even the wet cellulose taste of reconstituted artificial scrambled eggs was not enough to ruin Holden's warm, self-satisfied glow. He shoveled the faux eggs into his mouth, trying not to grin. Sitting at his left around the galley table, Amos ate with lip-smacking enthusiasm. To Holden's right, Alex pushed the limp eggs around on his plate with a piece of equally fake toast. Across the table, Naomi sipped a cup of tea and looked at him from under her hair. He stifled the urge to wink at her. They'd talked about how to break the news to the crew, but hadn't come to any consensus. Holden hated to hide anything. Keeping it secret made it seem dirty or shameful. His parents had raised him to believe that sex was something you did in private, not because it was embarrassing, but because it was intimate. With five fathers and three mothers, the sleeping arrangements were always complex at his house, but the discussions about who was bedding with whom were never hidden from him. It left him with a strong aversion to hiding his own activities. Naomi, on the other hand, thought they shouldn't do anything to upset the fragile equilibrium they'd found, and Holden trusted her instincts. She had an insight into group dynamics that he often lacked. So, for now, he was following her lead. Besides, it would have felt like boasting, and that would have been rude. Keeping his voice neutral and professional, he said, "Naomi, can you pass the pepper?" Amos's head snapped up, and he dropped his fork on the table with a loud clatter. "Holy shit, you guys are doing it!" Holden said, "What?" "Something's been screwy ever since we got back on the Rosie, but I couldn't figure. But that's it. You guys are finally playing hide the weasel." Holden blinked twice at the big mechanic, unsure of what to say. He glanced at Naomi for support, but her head was down and her hair completely covered her face. Her shoulders were shaking in silent laughter. "Jesus, Cap," Amos said, a grin on his wide face. "It fucking took you long enough. If she'd been throwing herself at me like that, I'd have been neck deep in that shit." Alex said, looking shocked enough that it was clear he hadn't shared Amos's insights. "Wow." Naomi stopped laughing and wiped tears away from the corners of her eyes. "Busted," she said. "Look, guys, it's important that you know this doesn't affect our—" Holden said, but Amos cut him off with a snort. "Hey, Alex," Amos said.
"Yo,"
Alex replied. "XO boning the captain gonna make you a really shitty pilot?"
"Don't believe it will,"
Alex said with a grin, exaggerating his drawl. "And oddly enough, I don't feel the need to be a lousy mechanic." Holden tried again. "I think it's important that—" "Captain," Amos continued, ignoring him, "consider that no one gives a fuck, it won't stop us from doing our jobs and just enjoy it, since we'll probably all be dead in a few days anyway." Naomi started laughing again. "Fine," she said. "I mean, everyone knows I'm only doing it to get a promotion. Oh, wait, right. Already the second in command. Hey, can I be captain now?" "No," Holden said, laughing. "It's a shit job. I'd never ask you to do it." Naomi grinned and shrugged. "See? I'm not always right." Holden glanced at Alex, who was looking at him with genuine affection, clearly happy about the idea of him and Naomi together. Everything seemed right. Iro spun like a potato-shaped top, its thick skin of rock hiding the horrors inside. Alex brought them in close, to do a thorough scan of the station. The asteroid swelled on Holden's screen until it looked close enough to touch. At the other op station, Naomi swept the surface with LADAR, looking for anything that might pose a danger to the Tycho freighter crews still a few days behind. On Holden's tactical display, the UNN science ship continued to flare in a braking maneuver toward Eros, its escort right beside it. "Still not talking, huh?" Holden asked. Naomi shook her head, then tapped on her screen and sent the comms monitoring information to his workstation. "Nope," she said. "But they see us. They've been bouncing radar off of us for a couple hours now." Holden tapped his fingers on the arm of his chair and thought about the choices. It was possible that the hull modifications Tycho had made to the Rosie were fooling the Earth Corvette's recognition software. They might just ignore the Rosie, thinking she was a belter gas runner that happened to be hanging around. but the Rosie was running without a transponder, which made her illegal no matter what hull configuration she was showing. That the Corvette wasn't trying to warn off a ship that was running dark made him nervous. The Belt and the Inner Planets were in a shooting war. A Belter ship with no identification was hanging around Eros while two Earth ships flew toward it. No way any captain with half a brain would just ignore them. The Corvette's silence meant something else. "Naomi, I have a feeling that Corvette is going to try and blow us up," Holden said with a sigh. "It's what I'd do," she replied. Holden tapped one last complicated rhythm on his chair, then put his headset on. "All right, I guess I make the first overture then," he said. Not wishing to make their conversation public, Holden targeted the Earther Corvette with the Rocinante's laser array and signaled a generic link-up request. After a few seconds, the link-established light went green, and his earplugs began to hiss with faint background static. Holden waited, but the UN ship offered no greeting. They wanted him to speak first. He flicked off his mic, switching to the ship-wide comm. "Alex, get us moving. 1G for now. If I can't bluff this guy, it'll be a shooting match. Be ready to open her up."
"Roger," drawled Alex. "Going on the juice just in case."
Holden glanced over at Naomi's station, but she'd already switched to her tactical screen and had the Rosie plotting firing solutions and jamming tactics on the two approaching ships. Naomi had been in only one battle, but she was reacting now like a seasoned veteran. He smiled at her back, then turned around before she had time to realize he was staring.
"Amos," he said. "Lock down and ship shape down here, Cap. The Rosie's pawing at the turf. Let's go kick some ass."
"Let's hope we don't have to," Holden thought. He turned his mic back on. "This is Captain James Holden of the Rocinante calling the captain of the approaching United Nations Navy Corvette. Call sign unknown. Please respond." There was a static-filled pause, followed by, "Rocinante, leave our flight path immediately. If you do not begin moving away from Eros at best possible speed, you will be fired upon." The voice was young, an aging Corvette with the tedious task of following an asteroid mapping ship around wouldn't be a much sought-after command. The captain was probably a lieutenant without patrons or prospects. He'd be inexperienced, but he might see a confrontation as an opportunity to prove himself to his superiors, and that made the next few moments treacherous to navigate.
"Sorry," said Holden. "Still don't know your call sign or your name, but I can't do what you want. In fact, I can't let anyone land on Eros. I'm going to need you to stop approaching the station."
"Rocinante, I don't think you..." Holden took control of the Rosie's targeting system and began painting the approaching Corvette with its targeting laser. "Let me explain what's happening here," he said. "Right now, you're looking at your sensors and you're seeing what looks like a thrown-together gas freighter that's giving your ship recognition software fits. And all of a sudden, meaning right now, it's painting you with a state-of-the-art target acquisition system. We don't..."
"Don't lie. I know that's what's happening. So here's the deal. Despite how it looks, my ship is newer, faster, tougher, and better armed than yours. The only way for me to really prove that is to open fire, and I'm hoping not to do that."
"Are you threatening me, Rocinante?" the young voice on Holden's headset said, its tone hitting just the right notes of arrogance and disbelief.
"You?"
"No," said Holden. "I'm threatening the big, fat, slow-moving, and unarmed ship you're supposed to be protecting. You keep flying toward Eros, and I will unload everything I've got at it. I guarantee we will blow that flying science lab out of the sky. Now, it's possible you might get us while we do it, but by then your mission is screwed anyway, right?" The line went silent again, only the hiss of background radiation letting him know his headset hadn't died. When his answer came, it came on the ship-wide comms. Alex said,
"They're stopping, Captain. They just started hard braking. Tracking says they'll be relative stopped about 2 million clicks out. Want me to keep flying toward them?"
"No. Bring us back to our stationary position over Eros," Holden replied.
"Roger that.
Naomi?"
Holden said, spinning his chair around to face her. Are they doing anything else? Not that I can see through the clutter of their exhaust, but they could be tight-beaming messages the other direction and we'd never know, she said. Holden flipped the shipwide comm off. He scratched his head for a minute, then unbuckled his restraints. Well, we stopped them for now. I'm going to hit the head and then grab a drink. Want anything? He's not wrong, you know, Naomi said later that night. Holden was floating in zero-G on the ops deck, his station a few feet away. He'd turned down the deck lights, and the cabin was as dim as a moonlit night. Alex and Amos were sleeping two decks below. They might as well have been a million light-years away. Naomi was floating near her own station, 2 meters away, her hair unbound and drifting around her like a black cloud. The panel behind her lit her face in profile, the long forehead, flat nose, large lips. He could tell that her eyes were closed. He felt like they were the only two people in the universe. Who's not wrong? He said, just to be saying something. Miller, she replied, as though it were obvious. I have no idea what you're talking about. Naomi laughed, then swatted with one hand to rotate her body and face him in the air. Her eyes were open now, though with the panel lights behind her, they were visible only as black pools in her face. I've been thinking about Miller, she said. I treated him badly on Tycho, ignored him because you were angry. I owed him better than that. Why? He saved your life on Eros. Holden snorted, but she kept going anyway. When you were in the Navy, she finally said, what were you supposed to do when someone went crazy on the ship? Started doing things that endangered everyone? Thinking they were talking about Miller, Holden said, you restrain him and remove him as a danger to the ship and crew. But Fred didn't. Naomi cut him off. What if it's wartime, she said. The middle of a battle. If he can't be easily restrained, the chief of the watch has an obligation to protect the ship and crew by whatever means necessary. Even shooting him? If that's the only way to do it, Holden replied. Sure. But it would only be in the most pressing circumstances. Naomi nodded with her hand, sending her body slowly twisting the other way. She stopped her motion with one unconscious gesture. Holden was pretty good in zero-G, but he'd never be that good. The belt is a network, Naomi said. It's like one big distributed ship. We have nodes that make air or water or power or structural materials. Those nodes may be separated by millions of kilometers of space, but that doesn't make them any less interconnected. I see where this is going, Holden said with a sigh. Dresden was a madman on the ship. Miller shot him to protect the rest of us. He gave me that speech back on Tycho. Didn't buy it then, either. Why? Because, Holden said, Dresden wasn't an immediate threat. He was just an evil little man in an expensive suit. He didn't have a gun in his hand or his finger on a bomb trigger. And I will never trust a man who believes he has the right to unilaterally execute people. Holden put his foot against the bulkhead and tapped off just hard enough to float a few feet closer to Naomi, close enough to see her eyes, read her reaction to him. If that science ship starts flying toward Eros again, I will throw every torpedo we have at it and tell myself I was protecting the rest of the solar system from what's on Eros. But I won't just start shooting at it now on the idea that it might decide to head to Eros again, because that's murder. What Miller did was murder. Naomi smiled at him, then grabbed his flight suit and pulled him close enough for a kiss. You might be the best person I know, but you're totally uncompromising on what you think is right. And that's what you hate about Miller. I do? Yes, she said. He's totally uncompromising too. But he has different ideas on how things work. You hate that. To Miller, Dresden was an active threat to the ship. Every second he stayed alive endangered everyone else around him. To Miller, it was self-defense. But he's wrong. The man was helpless. The man talked the UN Navy into giving his company state-of-the-art ships, she said. He talked his company into murdering 1.5 million people. Everything Miller said about why the protomolecule is better off with us was just as true about Dresden. How long is he in an OPA lockup before he finds the jailer who can be bought? He was a prisoner, Holden said, feeling the argument slipping away from him. He was a monster with power, access, and allies who would have paid any price to keep his science project going, Naomi said. And I'm telling you, as a Belter, Miller wasn't wrong. Holden didn't answer. He just continued to float next to Naomi, keeping himself in her orbit. Was he angrier about the killing of Dresden or about Miller's making a decision that disagreed with him? And Miller had known. When Holden had told him to find his own ride back to Tycho, he'd seen it in the detective's sad, basset hound face. Miller had known it was coming, and had made no attempt to fight or argue. That meant that Miller had made his choice fully cognizant of the cost, and ready to pay it. That meant something. Holden wasn't sure exactly what, but something. A red telltale began flashing on the wall, and Naomi's panel woke up and began throwing data onto the screen. She pulled herself down to it using the back of her chair, then tapped out several quick commands. Shit, she said. What is it? The Corvette or science ship must have called for help, Naomi said, pointing at her screen. We've got ships on their way from all over the system. How many are coming? Holden asked, trying to get a better look at her screen. Naomi made a small sound in the back of her throat, halfway between a chuckle and a cough. At a guess, all of them. Chapter 48. Miller. You are and you aren't, the Eros feed said through a semi-random drumming of static. You are and you aren't. You are and you aren't. The little ship shuddered and bumped. From a crash couch, one of the OPA techs called out a string of obscenities, remarkable more for inventiveness than actual rancor. Miller closed his eyes, trying to keep the micro-G adjustments of their non-standard docking from nauseating him. After days of joint-aching acceleration and an equally bruising braking routine, the small shifts and movements felt arbitrary and strange. You are. He'd spent some time listening to the news feeds. 3 days after they'd left Tycho, the news of Protogen's involvement with Eros broke. Amazingly, Holden hadn't been the one to do it. Since then, the corporation had gone from total denial to blaming a rogue subcontractor to claiming immunity under an Earth Defense Secret statute. It didn't sound good for them. Earth's blockade of Mars was still in place, but attention had shifted to the power struggle within Earth, and the Martian Navy had slowed its burn, giving the Earth forces a little more breathing room before any permanent decisions had to be made. It looked like they'd postponed Armageddon, for a few weeks anyway. Miller found he could take a certain joy in that. It also left him tired. More often, he listened to the voice of Eros. Sometimes he watched the video feeds too, but usually he just listened. Over the hours and days, he began to hear, if not patterns, at least common structures. Some of the voices spooling out of the dying station were consistent. Broadcasters and entertainers who were overrepresented in the audiophiles archives, he guessed. There seemed to be some specific tendencies in, for want of a better term, the music of it too. Hours of random, fluting static and snatched bits of phrases would give way, and Eros would latch on to some word or phrase, fixating on it with greater and greater intensity until it broke apart, and the randomness poured back in. Aren't, Miller thought. And the ship suddenly shoved itself up, leaving Miller's stomach about 1/2 foot from where it had been. A series of loud clanks followed, and then the brief wail of a klaxon. Dieu! Dieu! someone shouted. Bom sum vamin roja! Going to fry it! Fry us toda! There was the usual polite chuckle that the same joke had occasioned over the course of the trip, and the boy who'd made it, a pimply belter no more than 15 years old, grinned with pleasure at his own wit. If he didn't stop that shit, someone was going to beat him with a crowbar before they got back to Tycho. But Miller figured that someone wasn't him. A massive jolt forward pushed him hard into the couch, and then gravity was back. The familiar 0.3G. Maybe a little more. Except that with the airlocks pointing toward ships down, the pilot had to grapple the spinning skin of Eros's belly first. The spin gravity made what had been the ceiling the new floor. The lowest rank of couches was now the top. And while they rigged the fusion bombs to the docks, they were all going to have to climb up onto a cold, dark rock that was trying to fling them off into the vacuum. Such were the joys of sabotage. Miller suited up. After the military-grade suits of the Rosinante, the OPA's motley assortment of equipment felt like third-hand clothes. His suit smelled of someone else's body, and the Mylar faceplate had a deformation where it had cracked and been repaired. He didn't like thinking about what had happened to the poor bastard who'd been wearing it. The magnetic boots had a thick layer of corroded plastic and old mud between the plates and a triggering mechanism so old that Miller could feel it click on and off even before he moved his foot. He had the image of the suit locking on to Eros and never letting go. The thought made him smile. "You belong with me," his own private Julie had said. It was true, and now that he was here, he felt perfectly certain that he wasn't going to leave. He'd been a cop for too long, and the idea of trying to reconnect to humanity again filled him with a presentiment of exhaustion. He was here to do the last part of his job, and then he was done.
"Oi, Pampo!"
"I'm coming," Miller said. "Hold your damn horses. It's not like the station's going anyplace."
"A rainbow is a circle you can't see, can't see, can't see," Eros said in a child's sing-song voice. Miller turned down the volume of his feed. The rocky surface of the station had no particular purchase for the suits and control Waldos. Two other ships had made polar landings where there was no spin gravity to fight against, but the Coriolis would leave everyone with a subliminal nausea. Miller's team had to keep to the exposed metal plates of the dock, clinging like flies looking down into the starlit abyss. Engineering the placement of the fusion bombs wasn't trivial work. If the bombs didn't pump enough energy into the station, the surface might cool enough to give someone another chance to put a science team on it before the penumbra of the sun swallowed it and whatever parts of the Nauvoo were still clinging to it. Even with the best minds of Tycho, there was still the chance that the detonations wouldn't sync up. If the pressure waves traveling through the rock amplified in ways they hadn't anticipated, the station could crack open like an egg, spreading the protomolecule through the wide, empty track of the solar system like scattering a handful of dust. But the difference between success and disaster might be literally a question of meters. Miller crawled up the airlock and out to the station surface. The first wave of technicians were setting up resonant seismographs, the glow of the work lights and readouts the brightest thing in the universe. Miller set his boots on the wide swath of a ceramic steel alloy and let the spin stretch the kinks out of his back. After days in the acceleration couch, the freedom felt euphoric. One of the techs raised her hands, the physical belter idiom that called for attention. Miller upped the suit volume.
"Insect rampant sur ma peau."
With a stab of impatience, he switched from the Eros feed to the team channel.
"Got to move," a woman's voice said. "Too much splash back here. We have to get to the other side of the docks."
"These go on for almost 2 kilometers, Miller said.
"Yes," she agreed. "We can unmoor and move the ship under power, or we can tow it. We've got enough lead line."
"Which one's fastest? We don't have a lot of spare time here."
"Towing."
"Tow it then," Miller said. Slowly the ship rose.
20 small, crawling transport drones clinging to leads like they were hauling a great metallic zeppelin. The ship was going to stay with him, here in the station, strapped to the rock like a sacrifice to the gods. Miller walked with the crew as they crossed the wide, closed bay doors. The only sounds were the tapping of his soles as the electromagnets jolted onto the surface, and then a tick when they let go again. The only smells were his own body and the fresh plastic of the air recycler. The metal under his feet shone like someone had cleaned it. Any dust or pebbles had been hurled away long ago. They worked fast to place the ship, arm the bombs, and fit the security codes, everyone tacitly aware of the great missile that had been the Nauvoo speeding toward them. If another ship came down and tried to disarm the trap, the ship would send synchronizing signals to all the other OPA bomb ships studding the moon's surface. 3 seconds later, the surface of Eros would be scrubbed clean. The spare air and supplies were loaded off the ship, bundled together and ready for reclamation. No reason to waste the resources. Nothing horrific crawled out of an airlock and tried to attack the crew, which made Miller's presence during the mission entirely superfluous. Or maybe not. Maybe it was just a ride. When everything was done that could be, Miller sent the all-clear, relayed through the now-dead ship system. The return transport appeared slowly, a dot of light that grew gradually brighter and then spread. The null G boarding web strung out like scaffolding. At the new ship's word, Miller's team turned off their boots and fired simple maneuvering thrusters, either from their suits or, if the suits were too old, from shared ablative evacuation shells. Miller watched them drop away. "Kolvan roll, Pampa," Giogu said from someplace. Miller wasn't sure which of them he was at this distance. "This tube don't sit." "I'm not coming," Miller said.
"So, okay?"
"I decided. I'm staying here." There was a moment of silence. Miller had been waiting for this. He had the security codes. If he needed to crawl back into the shell of their old ship and lock the door behind him, he could. But he didn't want to. He'd prepared his arguments. He would only be going back to Tycho as a political pawn for Fred Johnson's negotiations. He was tired and old, in a way that years didn't describe. He'd already died on Eros once, and he wanted to be here to finish it. He'd earned that much. Giogu and the others owed it to him. He waited for the boy to react, to try to talk him out of it.
"All correct, then," Giogu said. "Buona morte."
"Buona morte," Miller said, and shut off his radio. The universe was silent. The stars below him shifted slowly but perceptibly as the station he hung from spun. One of those lights was the Rosinante. Two others were the ships Holden had been sent out to stall. Miller couldn't pick them out. Julie floated beside him, her dark hair floating in the vacuum, the stars shining through her. She looked peaceful. "If you had it to do again," she said, "if you could do it all over from the beginning?"
"I wouldn't," he said.
He watched the OPA transport ship start up its engines, glowing gold and white, and pull away until it was a star again. A small one. And then lost. Miller turned and considered the dark, empty moonscape and the permanent night. He just needed to be with her for another few hours, and they would both be safe. They would all be safe. It was enough. Miller found himself smiling and weeping, the tears tracking up from his eyes and into his hair.
"It's going to be fine," Julie said.
"I know," Miller said.
He stood silently for almost an hour, then turned and made his slow, precarious way back to the sacrificed ship, down the airlock, and into the dim belly. There was enough residual atmosphere that he didn't need to sleep in his suit. He stripped naked,
chose an acceleration couch, and curled up on the hard blue gel. Not 20 meters away, 5 fusion devices, powerful enough to outshine the sun, waited for a signal. Above him, everything that had once been human in Eros Station changed and reformed, pouring from one shape to another like Hieronymus Bosch made real. And still, almost a day away, the Nauvoo, the hammer of God, hurtled toward him. Miller set his suit to play some old pop tunes he'd enjoyed when he was young, and let himself be sung to sleep. When he dreamed he'd found a tunnel at the back of his old hole on Ceres that meant he would at last, be free. His last breakfast was a hard kibble bar and a handful of chocolate scrounged from a forgotten survival pack. He ate it with tepid recycled water that tasted of iron and rot. The signals from Eros were almost drowned by the oscillating frequencies blasting out from the station above him, but Miller made out enough to know where things stood. Holden had won, much as Miller had expected him to. The OPA was responding to 1,000 angry accusations from Earth and Mars, and, in the true and permanent style, factions within the OPA itself. It was too late. The Nauvoo was due in hours now. The end was coming. Miller put on his suit for the last time, turned out the lights, and crawled back up the airlock. For a long moment, the exterior release didn't respond, the safety lights glowing red, and he had a stab of fear that he would spend his last moments there, trapped in a tube like a torpedo ready to fire. But he cycled the lock's power, and it opened. The Eros feed was wordless now, with only a soft murmuring like water over stone. Miller walked out across the wide mouth of the docking bays. The sky above him turned, and the Nauvoo rose from the horizon like the sun. His splayed hand, held at full arm's length, wasn't big enough to cover the glow of its engines. He hung by his boots, watching the ship approach. The Phantom Julie watched with him. If he'd done the math right, the Nauvoo's impact site would be at the center of Eros's major axis. Miller would be able to see it when it happened, and the giddy excitement in his chest reminded him of being young. It would be a show. Oh, it would be something to see. He considered recording it. His suit would be able to make a simple visual file and stream the data out in real time. But no. This was his moment. His and Julie's. The rest of humanity could guess what it had been like, if they cared. The massive glow of the Nauvoo filled a quarter of the sky now, and the full circle of it was free of the horizon. The Eros feed's soft murmur shifted to something more clearly synthetic, a rising, spiraling sound that reminded him for no particular reason of the green, sweeping radar screens of ancient films. There were voices at the back of it, but he couldn't make out the words, or even the language. The great torch of the Nauvoo was a full half of the sky, the stars around it blotted out by the light of full burn. Miller's suit chirped a radiation warning, and he shut it off. A manned Nauvoo would never have sustained a burn like that. Even in the best couch, the thrust gravity would have pulped bones. He tried to guess how fast the ship would be going when it hit. Fast enough. That was all that mattered. Fast enough. There, in the center of the fiery bloom, Miller saw a dark spot, no more than the dot of a pencil's tip. The ship itself. He took a deep breath. When he closed his eyes, the light pressed red through his lids. When he opened them again, the Nauvoo had length, shape. It was a needle, an arrow, a missile, a fist rising from the depths. For the first time in memory, Miller felt awe. Eros shouted, "Don't you fucking touch me!" Slowly, the bloom of engine fire changed from a circle to an oval, to a great feathery plume, the Nauvoo itself showing silver in rough profile. Miller gaped. The Nauvoo had missed. It had turned. It was right now, speeding past Eros and not into it. But he hadn't seen any kind of maneuvering rockets fire. And how would you turn something that big, moving that quickly, so abruptly, that it would veer off between one breath and the next without also tearing the ship apart? The acceleration G alone. Miller looked at the stars, as if there were some answer written in them. And to his surprise, there was. The sweep of the Milky Way, the infinite scattering of stars were still there. But the angles had changed. The rotation of Eros had shifted. Its relation to the plane of the ecliptic. For the Nauvoo to change course at the last minute without falling apart would have been impossible. And so it hadn't happened. Eros was roughly 600 cubic kilometers. Before Protogen, it had housed the second largest active port in the belt. And without so much as overcoming the grip of Miller's magnetic boots, Eros Station had dodged. Chapter 49. Holden. "Holy shit," said Amos in a flat voice. "Jim," Naomi said to Holden's back, but he waved her off and opened a channel to Alex in the cockpit. "Alex, did we just see what my sensors say we saw?"
"Yeah, Cap," the pilot replied. "Radar and scopes are both saying Eros jumped 200 clicks spinward in a little less than a minute."
"Holy shit," Amos repeated, in exactly the same emotionless tone. The metallic bang of deck hatches opening and closing echoed through the ship, signaling Amos's approach up the crew ladder. Holden shook off the flush of irritation he felt at Amos's leaving his post. He'd deal with that later. He needed to be sure that the Rosinante and her crew hadn't just experienced a group hallucination. "Naomi, give me comms," he said. Naomi turned around in her chair to face him, her face ashen. "How can you be so calm?" she asked.
"Panic won't help. We need to know what's going on before we can plan intelligently. Please transfer the comms to me."
"Holy shit," Amos said as he climbed into the ops deck. The deck hatch shut with a punctuating bang.
"I don't remember ordering you to leave your post, sailor," Holden said.
"Plan intelligently," Naomi said, like they were words in a foreign language that she almost understood. "Plan intelligently." Amos threw himself at a chair hard enough that the cushioning gel grabbed him and kept him from bouncing off.
"Eros is really fucking big," Amos said.
"Plan intelligently," Naomi repeated, speaking to herself now.
"I mean really fucking big," Amos said. "Do you know how much energy it took to spin that rock up? I mean, it took years to do that shit."
Holden put his headset on to drown Amos and Naomi out and called up Alex again.
"Alex, is Eros still changing velocity?"
"No, Cap, just sitting there like a rock."
"Okay," Holden said. "Amos and Naomi are vapor locked. How are you doing?"
"Not taking my hands off the stick while that bastard is anywhere in my space, that's for damn sure."
Thank God for military training, Holden thought.
"Good. Keep us at a constant distance of 5,000 clicks until I say otherwise. Let me know if it moves again, even an inch."
"Roger that, Cap," said Alex.
Holden took off his headset and turned to face the rest of the crew. Amos was looking at the ceiling, ticking points off with his fingers, his eyes unfocused.
"Don't really remember the mass of Eros off the top of my head," he was saying to no one in particular.
"About 7,000 trillion kilos," Naomi replied, "give or take. And the heat signature's up about 2 degrees.
"Jesus," the mechanic said. "I can't do that math in my head. That much mass coming up 2 degrees like that?"
"A lot," Holden said. "So let's move on."
"About 10 exajoules, Naomi said. "That's just off the top of my head, but I'm not off by an order of magnitude or anything."
Amos whistled.
10 exajoules is like, what, a 2-gigaton fusion bomb?
It's about 100 kilos converted directly to energy. Naomi said. Her voice began to steady. Which, of course, we couldn't do. But at least whatever they did wasn't magic. Holden's mind grabbed onto her words with an almost physical sensation. Naomi was, in fact, about the smartest person he knew. She had just spoken directly to the half-articulated fear he'd been harboring since Eros had jumped sideways. That this was magic. That the proto-molecule didn't have to obey the laws of physics. Because if that was true, humans didn't stand a chance. "Explain," he said. "Well," she replied, tapping on her keypad. "Heating Eros up didn't move it. So I assume that means it was waste heat from whatever it was they actually did. And that means that entropy still exists, that they can't convert mass to energy with perfect efficiency, that their machines or processes or whatever they use to move 7,000 trillion kilos of rock wastes some energy, about a 2 gigaton bomb's worth of it." "Ah, you couldn't move Eros 200 kilometers with a 2 gigaton bomb," Amos said with a snort. "No, you couldn't," Naomi replied. "This is just the leftovers. Heat byproduct. Their efficiency is still off the charts, but it isn't perfect. Which means the laws of physics still hold. Which means it isn't magic."
"Might as well be," Amos said.
Naomi looked at Holden. "So we..." He started when Alex interrupted over the shipwide comm.
"Cap, Eros is moving again."
"Follow it. Get me a course and speed as soon as you can," Holden said, turning back to his console. "Amos, get back down to engineering. If you leave it again without a direct order, I'll have the XO beat you to death with a pipe wrench." The only reply was the hiss of the deck hatch opening and the bang as it closed behind the descending mechanic. "Alex," Holden said, staring at the data stream the Rosinante was feeding him about Eros, "tell me something."
"Sunward is all we know for sure,"
Alex replied, his voice still calm and professional. When Holden had been in the military, he'd been officer track right from the start. He'd never been to military pilot school, but he knew that years of training had compartmentalized Alex's brain into two halves, piloting problems and, secondarily, everything else. Matching Eros and getting a course for it was the former. Extrasolar space aliens trying to destroy humanity wasn't a piloting issue, and could be safely ignored until he left the cockpit. He might have a nervous breakdown afterward, but until then, Alex would keep doing his job. "Drop back to 50,000 clicks and maintain a constant distance," Holden told him.
"Huh," said Alex. "Maintaining a constant distance might be tough, Cap. Eros just disappeared off the radar."
Holden felt his throat go tight. "Say again?"
"Eros just disappeared off the radar,"
Alex was saying, but Holden was already punching up the sensor suite to check for himself. His telescope showed the rock still moving on its new course toward the sun. Thermal imaging showed it is slightly warmer than space. The weird feed of voices and madness that had been leaking out of the station was still detectable, if faint. But radar said there was nothing there. "Magic," a small voice at the back of his mind said again. No, not magic. Humans had stealth ships, too. It was just a matter of absorbing the radar's energy rather than reflecting it. But suddenly, keeping the asteroid in visual range became all the more important. Eros had shown that it could move fast and maneuver wildly, and it was now invisible to radar. It was entirely possible that a mountain-sized rock could disappear completely. Gravity began to pile up as the Rosie chased Eros toward the sun. "Naomi?" She looked up at him. The fear was still in her eyes, but she was holding it together. For now. "Jim? The comm, could you?" The chagrin on her face was the most reassuring thing he'd seen in hours. She shifted control to his station, and he opened a connection request. "UNN Corvette, this is the Rosinante. Please respond." "Go ahead, Rosinante," the other ship said after half a minute of static. "Calling to confirm our sensor data," Holden said, then transmitted the data regarding Eros's movement.
You guys seeing the same thing?
Another delay. This one longer.
Roger that, Rocinante.
I know we were just about to shoot each other and all, but I think we're a little past that now, Holden said. Anyway, we're chasing the rock. If we lose sight of it, we might never find it again. Want to come with?
Might be nice to have some backup if it decides to shoot at us or something.
Another delay. This one almost 2 minutes long. Then a different voice came on the line. Older, female, and totally lacking the arrogance and anger of the young male voice he'd been dealing with so far.
Rocinante, this is Captain McBride of the UNN escort vessel Ravi.
Ah, thought Holden. I've been talking to the first officer all along. The captain finally took the horn. That might be a good sign.
I've sent word to Fleet Command, but it's a 23-minute lag right now, and that rock's putting on speed. You have a plan?
Not really, Ravi. Just follow and gather intel until we find an opportunity to do something that makes a difference. But if you came along, maybe none of your people will shoot at us accidentally while we figure it out.
There was a long pause.
Holden knew that the captain of the Ravi was weighing the chance that he was telling the truth against the threat he'd made against their science vessel. What if he was in on whatever was happening? He'd be wondering the same thing in their position.
Look, he said, I've told you my name, James Holden. I served as a lieutenant in the UNN. My record should be on file. It'll show a dishonorable discharge, but they'll also show that my family lives in Montana. I don't want that rock to hit Earth any more than you do.
The silence on the other end continued for another few minutes.
Captain, she said, I believe my superiors would want me to keep an eye on you. We'll be coming along for the ride while the brains figure this out.
Holden let out a long, noisy exhale.
Thanks for that, McBride. Keep trying to get your people on the line. I'm going to make a few calls myself. Two corvettes are not going to fix this problem.
Roger that, the Ravi replied, then killed the connection.
I've opened a connection with Tycho, Naomi said.
Holden leaned back in his chair, the mounting gravity of their acceleration pressing against him. A watery lump was gathering low in his gut, the loose knot telling him that he had no idea what he was doing, that all the best plans had failed, and that the end was near. The brief hope he'd felt was already starting to slip away.
How can you be so calm?
I think I'm watching the end of the human race, Holden thought. I'm calling Fred so that it isn't my fault when no one has an idea how to stop it. Of course I'm not calm. I'm just spreading the guilt.
How fast? Fred Johnson asked incredulously.
4 G's now and climbing, Holden replied, his voice thick as his throat compressed.
Oh, and it's invisible to radar now.
4G? Do you know how heavy Eros is?
There's been some discussion, Holden said,
only the acceleration keeping his impatience from showing in his voice.
The question is, now what? The Nauvoo missed. Our plans are shot to shit.
There was another perceptible increase in pressure as Alex sped the ship up to keep up with Eros. A little while longer, and speech wouldn't be possible.
It's definitely headed for Earth? Fred asked.
Alex and Naomi are 90% or so. Hard to be totally accurate when we can only use visual data, but I trust them. I'd go to where there are 30 billion new hosts, too.
30 billion new hosts, 8 of whom were his parents.
He imagined Father Tom as a bundle of tubes oozing brown goo, Mother Elise as a ribcage dragging itself across the floor with one skeletal arm. And with that much biomass, what could it do then? Move Earth? Turn out the sun?
Have to warn them, Holden said, trying not to strangle on his own tongue as he spoke.
You don't think they know?
They see a threat. They may not see the end of all native life in the solar system, Holden said.
You wanted a reason to sit at the table? How about this one? Come together or die.
Fred was quiet for a moment. Background radiation spoke to Holden in mystic whispers full of dire portents while he waited.
Newcomer, it said, hang around for 14 billion years or so.
See what I've seen. Then all this nonsense won't seem so important.
I'll see what I can do, Fred said, interrupting the universe's lecture on transience. In the meantime, what are you going to do?
Get outrun by a rock and then watch the cradle of humanity die, Holden thought.
I'm open to suggestions, Holden said. Maybe you could detonate some of the surface nukes the demo team put down. Deflect Eros's course. Buy us time.
They're on proximity fuses. Can't set them off, Holden said, the last word turning into a yelp as his chair stabbed him in a dozen different places and injected him full of fire. Alex had hit them with the juice, which meant Eros was still speeding up, and he was worried they'd all black out. How fast was it going to go? Even on the juice, they couldn't sustain prolonged acceleration past 7 or 8 G without serious risk. If Eros kept this rate of increase up, it would outrun them.
You can remote detonate, Fred said. Miller will have the codes. Have the demo team calculate which ones to set off for maximum effect.
Roger that, Holden said. I'll give Miller a call.
I'll work on the inners, Fred said, using the belter's slang without a hint of self-consciousness. See what I can do.
Holden broke the connection, then linked up to Miller's ship.
Yo, said whoever was manning the radio there. This is Holden on the Rocinante. Give me Miller.
Said the voice. Okay. There was a click, then static, then Miller saying hello with a faint echo. Still wearing his helmet then.
Miller, this is Holden. We need to talk about what just happened.
Eros moved. Miller sounded strange, his voice distant, as though he was only barely paying attention to the conversation. Holden felt a flush of irritation, but tamped it back down. He needed Miller right now, whether he wanted to or not.
Look, he said, I've talked to Fred and he wants us to coordinate with your demo guys. You've got remote codes. If we set off all of them on one side, we can deflect its course. Get your techs on the line and we'll work it out.
Huh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I'll send the codes along, said Miller, his voice no longer distant but holding back a laugh, like a man about to tell the punchline of a really good joke.
But I can't really help you with the techs.
Shit, Miller, you pissed those people off too?
Miller did laugh now, a free, soft sound that someone who wasn't piling on G could afford. If there was a punchline, Holden had missed it.
Yeah, Miller said, probably. But that's not why I can't get them for you. I'm not on the ship with them.
What?
I'm still on Eros.
Chapter 50. Miller.
What do you mean you're on Eros? Holden said.
Pretty much that, Miller said, covering his growing sense of shame with a casual tone of voice. Hanging upside down outside the tertiary docks where we moored one of the ships. Feel like a freaking bat. But funny thing, too. I didn't feel it when the thing moved. You'd think accelerating like that, it would have thrown me off or squashed me flat, one or the other. But there was nothing.
Okay, hold on. We're coming to get you.
Holden, Miller said. Just stop it, all right?
The silence didn't last more than a dozen seconds, but it carried a wealth of meaning. It's not safe to bring the Rocinante to Eros, and I came here to die, and don't make this harder than it is.
Yeah, I just, Holden said, and then, okay, let me coordinate with the technicians. I'll let you know what they say.
One thing, though, Miller said.
You're talking about deflecting this son of a bitch? Just keep in mind it's not a rock anymore. It's a ship.
Right, Holden said, and a moment later, okay.
The connection dropped with a tick. Miller checked his oxygen supply. 3 hours in suit, but he could head back to his little ship and refill it well before that. So, Eros was moving, was it? He still didn't feel it, but watching the curved surface of the asteroid, he could see micro-asteroids all coming from the same direction, bouncing off. If the station kept accelerating, they'd start coming more often, more powerfully. He'd need to stay in the ship. He turned his hand terminal back to the Eros feed. The station beneath him was chirping and muttering, long, slow vowel sounds radiating out from it like recorded whale song. After the angry words and static, the voice of Eros sounded peaceful. He wondered what kind of music Giogu's friends would be making out of this. Slow dancing didn't seem like their style. An annoying itch settled in the small of his back, and he shifted in his suit, trying to rub it away. Almost without his noticing it, he grinned, and then laughed. A wave of euphoria passed into him. There was alien life in the universe, and he was riding on it, like a tick on a dog. Eros Station had moved of its own free will and by mechanisms he couldn't begin to imagine. He didn't know how many years it had been since he'd been overwhelmed by awe. He'd forgotten the feeling. He raised his arms to his sides, reaching out as if he could embrace the endless dark vacuum below him. Then, with a sigh, he turned back toward the ship. Back in the protective shell, he took off the vac suit and hooked the air supply to the recyclers to charge up. With only one person to care for, even low-level life support would have it ready to go within the hour. The ship batteries were still almost fully charged. His hand terminal chimed twice, reminding him that it was once again time for the anti-cancer meds. The ones he'd earned the last time he'd been on Eros. The ones he'd be on for the rest of his life. Good joke. The fusion bombs were in the ship's cargo hold. Gray, square boxes about half again as long as they were tall, like bricks in a mortar of pink adhesive foam. It took Miller 20 minutes of searching through storage lockers to find a can of solvent that still had charge in it. The thin spray from it smelled like ozone and oil, and the stiff pink foam melted under it. Miller squatted beside the bombs and ate a ration bar that tasted convincingly like apples. Julie sat beside him, her head resting weightlessly on his shoulder. There had been a few times that Miller had flirted with faith. Most had been when he was young and trying out everything. Then, when he was older, wiser, more worn, and in the crushing pain of the divorce. He understood the longing for a greater being, a huge and compassionate intelligence that could see everything from a perspective that dissolved the pettiness and evil and made everything all right. He still felt that longing. He just couldn't convince himself it was true. And still, maybe there was something like a plan. Maybe the universe had put him in the right place at the right time to do the thing that no one else would do. Maybe all the pain and suffering he'd been through, all the disappointments and soul-crushing years wallowing through the worst that humanity had to offer up, had been meant to bring him here, to this moment, when he was ready to die if it bought humanity a little time. "It would be pretty to think so," Julie said in his mind. "It would," he agreed with a sigh. At the sound of his voice, the vision of her vanished. Just another daydream. The bombs were heavier than he'd remembered. Under a full G, he wouldn't have been able to move them. At only one-third, it was a struggle, but possible. An agonizing centimeter at a time, he dragged one of them onto a handcart and hauled it to the airlock. Eros above him sang to itself. He had to rest before he tackled the hard work. The airlock was thin enough that only the bomb or he could fit through at a time. He climbed on top of it to get out the airlock door, then had to lift the bomb out with straps he rigged from cargo netting. And once out, it had to be tethered to the ship with magnetic clamps to keep Eros's spin from slinging it out into the void. After he'd pulled it out and strapped it to the cart, he stopped to rest for half an hour. There were more impacts now, a rough sign that Eros was indeed accelerating. Each one a rifle shot,
capable of bouncing clean through him or the ship behind him if bad luck sent it in the right direction. But the odds were low of one of the occasional rocks lining up a killing shot with his tiny, ant-like figure crawling across the surface. Once Eros cleared the belt, they'd stop anyway. Was Eros leaving the belt? He realized he had no idea where Eros was going. He'd assumed it was Earth. Holden would know by now, probably.